You have been listening to 93.3 WNRB Wausau. Real life, real learning, real radio. Coming up next, a show the NSA always loves to listen into and stop tapping my phones. This is The Mike Cannon Show.
Warning, the views expressed on The Mike Cannon Show, or the segments brought to you on this indie media radio show do not necessarily reflect the views of WNRB nor WNRB's host.
This is my boomstick!
The Mike Cannon Show.
I know you're out there. I can feel you now. I know that you're afraid. You're afraid of us. You're afraid of change. I don't know the future. I didn't come here to tell you how this is going to end. I came here to tell you how it's going to begin. I'm going to show these people what you don't want them to see. I'm going to show them a world without you. A world without rules and controls, without borders or boundaries. A world where anything is possible. Where we go from there is a choice I leave to you.
Welcome again to another installment of this indie media. That is indie as in independent media for Central Wisconsin, The Mike Cannon Show. Each week we try to bring you non-corporate voices and opinions from around the country and the world. Voices produced on other not-for-profit and or community radio stations. Voices you hear nowhere else except on this indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Got any gripes, suggestions, or comments about this show? You can always contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's all one word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. We got a full show for you this week. But first, a new segment I'll bring you each week called The Best Of. A very brief report or summary of items from last week's show that you'll not hear on Main Street media like the All Hate AM radio station here in town. This week, we have a tie for the underreported news items. The first one of two reports from last week's show, we heard about VP Cheney had filed his tax returns and reported $9.7 million of income last year. Of that $9.7 million he made, due large part to the corporate tax breaks that Bush wanted make permanent, he only had to pay 5.4% of. Yep, out of the nearly $10 million Cheney made last year, he paid less than a little over $500,000 in taxes. How'd you do on your taxes last year? Tied for last week's VP Cheney not paying very much taxes report was another report you did not hear on local news. Apparently, in Iraq, over 150 NGOs or non-government organizations working in Iraq reported that their own internal counting had over 20,000 Iraqis being kidnapped since January of this year. So in the first 4 months of this year, over 20,000 Iraqis have been kidnapped. And the right-wing nutcases only want you to believe that there are hospitals going up all the time while not telling you that the security for the average Iraqi is just plain terrible. Which news items to Iraqis think are more important? And did you hear about these NGO reports in Iraq on any local controlled corporate media? So that's this week's best of reports from last week's show. I guarantee that if you listen to this week's Mike Cannon Show, you hear a lot more items never mentioned on your corporately controlled media like the All Hate AM radio station here in town. One such report will be coming up shortly, and I must give you this disclaimer. The report is very, very difficult to hear. It is a report by a returning Iraqi Army veteran who spoke out last week in Michigan and will talk in a very graphic way about what he witnessed while he is serving in U.S. prisons like Abu Ghraib and other U.S. prison camps that are being run by our government. Again, this report is of a very graphic nature and may offend some listeners, especially the right-wing nut jobs out there who want to believe that there are just a few bad apples in Iraq. That report will be heard later in the show. But first, since it's May Day, a special short report on this labor-driven international holiday. As immigrants and U.S. citizens once again take to the streets, fighting for fair protection in the workplace, it is no accident they are choosing May Day as a day for protest. The history of May Day started 120 years ago when labor and union members tried to fight for their rights all over the Midwest, in places like Chicago, where anti-union corporations backed by bribe police tried to bust up unions. Fighting for an 8-hour work week, over 80,000 marched on May 1, 1886, as the police in Chicago, Illinois were especially brutal with their beatings and other illegal intimidation of anarchist and union organizers. These continuing brutalities led to bombs being thrown at police 4 days later at the Chicago Haymaker Square, killing or wounding some police officers. In retribution for this bombing, a sham trial of anarchist union organizers was held, and 4 prisoners, Parsons, Spies, Fisher, and Ingalls, were hung with little or no evidence. Many believe that this was the start of union organizers, but it took until the New Deal, Fair Labor Standards Acts of 1935 for the 8-hour work week to be legally established. There is a Haymaker Martyrs Memorial set up in a Chicago cemetery, where you can also visit another prominent and more famous anarchist, Emma Goldman. It's well worth a trip if you're ever in the Chicago area to check out this memorial. The Chicago Monument can be seen as a reminder that a great movement for a more humane workplace was delayed but not strangled with the Haymarket Martyrs. When we gather in its presence or gather on the streets today for immigrant rights, we also can recall that the untold millions of working men and women whose unremitting toil and suffering has prolonged for years by the tragedy of the Haymarket events. Lest we forget. Without labor's efforts, there would be no 8-hour workday, no child labor laws, no factory safety standards. So as the right wing comes out and criticizes the immigrant marches of today, May 1st, 2006, ask yourself who's defending the workers' rights in this country. Labor or the right wing corporations and the hate AM radio stations they have in their back pockets. In honor of this day, May Day 2006, up next a few labor reports, but first a brief summary of May Day by Mr. Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State out of Seattle, Washington. That's what we do each week on the Mike Cannon Show, indie media radio for Central Wisconsin, bringing you alternative voices and views from around the world. As always, thanks for tuning in to this indie media radio program, the Mike Cannon Show, normally heard starting at 2 p.m. every Monday. Happy May Day.
May Day returns to its roots. This is Jav Parrish. For many older Americans, May Day brings to mind images of Soviet soldiers goose-stepping through Red Square behind massive tanks while millions of onlookers obediently cheer. But May Day is an American holiday, one celebrated for the last century everywhere in the world except America, and one whose origins are well worth remembering, because May Day began as a strike for basic workplace rights we're now in the process of losing. That strike was largely by immigrant workers, which is exactly what America will see when immigrants and their supporters strike, march, and rally across the country on a National Day of Action for Comprehensive Immigration Reform this coming Monday, May Day. The first May Day, International Workers Day, in 1886, began as a series of general strikes in Chicago and other Midwestern cities for the 8-hour workday. The strike took on particular significance when, 2 days later, police attacked striking workers on Chicago's South Side, killing 4 and injuring over 200. At a rally the following day to protest the police attack, a bomb went off at Chicago's Haymarket Square, killing 8 police. The bombing led to death sentences for 8 leading anarchists, including several German immigrants, convicted with no evidence at all for conspiracy to commit murder. The hostility to organized labor whipped up over Haymarket meant that, in turn, May Day became an international labor rallying cry for the right of workers to organize in general and for the 8-hour workday in particular. By the end of the decade, May Day was a holiday celebrated by workers and workers' movements in every industrialized country in the world. It took another entire generation of struggle, but by 1912, federal workers in the U.S. were granted the 8-hour day. And in 1917, while America was desperate for the cooperation of unions in the war effort, the 8-Hour Act became law. And there, one would think, the matter was settled. Okay, quick, do you actually only work 8 hours in a day? Only 40 hours in a week? 5 days? Not very many of us do. Not any longer. We stay longer in the office. We take work home with us. We take work everywhere with us. nor do we get anywhere close to the vacation or sick day benefits workers get in other industrialized countries. And let's not even talk about healthcare coverage, which isn't even linked to one's workplace in most of the industrialized world. It's accepted as a universal need and right. Income for most working families in the U.S. isn't keeping up with inflation. And for all of these effective losses in compensation for our work, we're still working harder and longer hours than our grandparents. It's not too different now, really, from 1886. Then, as now, big business was exploiting the desperation and relative powerlessness of cheap immigrant labor, and in the process, trying to depress the wages and establish exploitative precedents for all workers. Then, as now, much of the rest of the public feared and distrusted a part of the labor force that often didn't even speak English. Then, as now, the immigrants had finally had enough, and marched and struck. This Monday, the largest wave yet of immigrant marches and rallies will take place in scores of cities across the U.S. Their immediate focus is stopping proposed congressional legislation, but the larger context is America's corporate-friendly trade policies. The World Bank and the array of impenetrable global trade acronyms, WTO, IMF, NAFTA, CAFTA, and so on, have decimated economies in Mexico and other poorer countries, and those trade policies have spurred economic emigration to America, while at the same time exporting millions of better-paying jobs from America to poorer countries. The immigrant struggle is not just legal, but economic, and a matter of self-respect and self-preservation. It is, in important ways, the leading edge of a struggle all American workers are facing. On Monday, find the immigration march in your community. Join it. Get inspired. Happy May Day. From KBCS, for the Pacifica Network, this is Jav Parrish.
Hey there, sexy. Have you come to play? That's right, big boy. Enjoy the Mike Cannon Show. And now, the man who doesn't misrepresent evidence to the UN, Mike Cannon.
That first bit was Gov Parrish of Beat the State fame talking a little bit about the history of May Day and then two fast labor news reports, information about most of us. Coming up next, we go again to this week's Sunday morning show out of Seattle, and we hear once again the voice of Gov Parrish, again from Eat the State, given this week's wrap-up of events. Funny, funny stuff coming up. He'll talk about the ever-increasing anti-war Senate office sit-ins that is happening around the country, Roe's up-and-coming indictment that can be coming up next week, Condoleezza Rice now being charged with her own leaking of classified materials, and Bush signing the bill not passed by Congress, as well as six New Jersey teenagers suing Rumsfeld, and many, many news items you will not hear anywhere else except on this indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. As a side note, you know, as the pile of evidence starts to pile on and get higher and higher, I'm taken aback by our all-hate AM radio station announcer and his consistent ranting and crying about omissions. You see, this pillar of virtue who likes to ride his motorcycle drunk and buy drinks for bubbles and candy at the local strip joint always whines about his show and about the liberal media. You know, kind of like Bill O'Reilly and his phone sex thing. But I digress. Anyway, I can't mention the station guy or the announcer's name, but let's call him Tap. Each day, Tap cries that you can omit news and that the liberal media is not reporting his kind of news. Well, ask yourself how many of the following items about to be reported on the next Eat the State program does he talk about on his show? You won't hear this stuff on his right-wing nutcase show. Talk about omission. He can't handle the truth, and I'm tired of his omissions. Tap hides in the green zone and think he knows what's going on in the world, but he's like a big old ostrich, butt up in the air and head in the sand. Tap, you're a right-wing hack who can't face the reality of his own actions, let alone the reality of what's happening in the world. Your spin is spinning out of control. Here's more news you'll never hear on the corporate-controlled media like the all-hate AM radio station here in town. Here's more independent news done right. Here is this week's Eat the State out of Seattle, Washington.
It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
We got so much to pack in today. I'm just not even going to start with the niceties. That I know
Probably a good idea.
All right. Moving along, there was a sit-in this week in Maria Cantwell's office.
Yes, and you probably didn't hear anything about it unless you maybe read the Stranger's blog or the new Eat the State that's come out. I think KUOW had something on it on Tuesday when seven activists went into Maria Cantwell's office at noon and said that they weren't going to leave until Maria Cantwell changed her position on the war, basically. They had about 90 minutes on the phone with a senior aide in Washington, D.C., who gave the usual apologetics. And then 5:30 came when the building normally closed and they expected to get arrested. And Cantwell's staff was so sensitive about the possibility of publicity around this, and obviously they did a pretty good job of suppressing the publicity since it wasn't covered by the dailies, wasn't covered by any TV stations, etc., that they kept the office open all night. Two of Cantwell's staffers stayed all night so that the there was one woman in the group and she decided to bow out at 5:30 because she didn't want to be the only woman who's arrested and separated out and sent to jail. But the six people that were remaining, including the father of the local father of a or a soldier who was killed in Iraq, several other people who were involved in military families, Rich Gamble, pastor of a local church, Howard Gale, who's been involved in a lot of anti-war organizing. I mean, you know, people that are fairly prominent in the anti-war movement in this area. Six folks stayed. They stayed all night. They stayed into the following day, and at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, they suspended the sit-in when they got an agreement from Cantwell to meet with them when she's back in town during a congressional recess on May 6th. What they're saying is if the results of that meeting are not satisfactory, they reserve the right to start the sit-in all over again. And, you know, if they do, maybe they'll have some other folks joining them this time because hopefully we can publicize it a little farther. But this is one of a number of sit-ins that have occurred around the country against mostly Democratic senators who have either supported the war or have been urged to do more to oppose the war. There was one last month where 19 people were arrested in Ron Wyden's Portland office. So this is something that's happening around the country, and hopefully we can see more of it here because we definitely need to see more pressure, particularly put on Maria Cantwell around her support of the war.
All right, and Cantwell this week filed a complaint?
Yeah, actually, it's the Democratic Party that did on behalf of Cantwell against Mike McGavick, her Republican opponent, probably in the general election. McGavick, of course, is the former CEO of Safeco and an insurance industry lobbyist. When he decided to resign his position at Safeco in order to run for the Senate, Safeco provided him with a very, very nice golden parachute. Now, it turns out not only did they do that, but they kept him on the payroll until after January 1st as a quote-unquote consultant, and by doing so gave him an additional $13 million worth of stock options. There's a total of $17 million that they've given McGavick after he announced for Senate. And what the Democrats are alleging is that this basically is a backdoor campaign contribution, money that Gavick can then turn around and pour into his Senate campaign, and he's already put a fair amount of his own money into the campaign. It'll be very, very interesting to see how the FEC handles this complaint. It's a fairly major complaint, and one that I think is, you know, pretty justified, because clearly Safeco is, what they're doing is making an awful lot of money available to McGavick at the exact same time that he also coincidentally needs an awful lot of money to run for the U.S. Senate.
All right. Well, moving to national, there is a big national event coming up on Monday.
Many big national events, actually, but it's all part of a coordinated day of action for comprehensive immigration reform. The immigrants will be striking and marching and rallying once again, probably almost certainly the biggest event so far. The organizers in Los Angeles, for example, are expecting 2 to 3 million people in Los Angeles alone. And this will actually be the first day that these marches have occurred simultaneously all across the country. In the past, there have been a number on the same day, but not in every city where these marches have been held. On Monday, May Day, that will
will be the case. May Day, of course, for folks who have forgotten, started in 1886 in Chicago as International Workers' Day. And, you know, not only is it a day for workers, but in Chicago in 1886, most of the workers and the families were foreign immigrants, particularly German immigrants. The Haymarket bombing that sent eight anarchists got death sentences off of. I think five of those anarchists were actually German immigrants. So it hasn't changed that much since 1886. Then as now, you know, corporations were trying to exploit cheap immigrant labor. A lot of English-speaking Americans were distrusted and feared. The immigrant part of the labor force that didn't even speak English. And finally, in 1886, the immigrants had had enough and stood up and started striking and marching. And that's exactly what's happened in 2006 and what's going to happen on Monday. Here in Seattle, folks will gather at 3:30 at 20th and Jackson. You're asked to wear black, and there will be a silent march to the federal building. And I'll repeat that also at the end of the half hour.
All right. Karl Rove getting some special attention this week.
Yes. Jason Leopold of Truth Out, who I've quoted on this show before, was reporting yesterday that Patrick Fitzgerald, now that he's coming off of his successful conviction of Illinois Governor George Ryan on corruption charges, is turning his full attention to the Valerie Plame Wilson case. And he is asking a grand jury this week to consider indicting Rove. And he wants to do it on charges of perjury, on charges of lying to investigators in 2003. The perjury was to a grand jury in 2004, and a possibility also of obstruction of justice, depending on what Rove said when he was called to testify before the grand jury again this past Wednesday. So look for that. If the grand jury decides to go along with it, there will be an announcement probably on Friday. And that could obviously throw a big monkey wrench into the Republicans' plans to have Rove mastermind their attempt to hang on to the control of the Senate and the House in 2006. So it could be a very, very big deal, not just for the indictment of Rove, but for what it means for Republicans' election chances in 2006. Meantime, very interestingly, there's another case going on in which two AIPAC lobbyists, that's right, there is an Israeli lobby, even though you may have read that there's not, are accused of trying to obtain classified information. And the lawyers for those said this week that the source of the classified information for the lobbyists that are now being charged with trying to obtain it were several senior administration officials, including none other than Condoleezza Rice. So in addition to President Bush having been outed as leaking classified information, it looks like Condoleezza Rice now is also being outed for the same thing and leaking it in this case to a sympathetic pro-Israel lobby. So keep an eye on this one as well.
All right, moving along. John Conyers is looking at suing.
Not looking at doing. He's done it. 10 congressional Democrats, led by John Conyers, are suing over the little stunt that's been pulled by President Bush, where in a budget bill that was passed in February had a late amendment added to it that included some additional money for an entitlement, and Bush decided he didn't like that provision. So what did he do? He signed an earlier version of the bill. In other words, he signed a version that had never been passed by the House of Representatives. This is, you know, somewhat unconstitutional, and Conyers and his colleagues are suing in order to get that presidential signature rescinded, because Bush does not have the right under the Constitution to sign into law legislation that has not been passed in identical fashion by both houses. So again, keep an eye on this one, and it's yet another example of Bush making up the Constitution as he goes along. It's a very, very worrisome attitude on behalf of the White House.
All right. And I understand that Donald Rumsfeld is also being sued.
Yes, he is. He's being sued by six New York teenagers. And what they are suing him over, and the reason that those teenagers have standing, is that the Pentagon has, and this was announced late last year, or I don't think announced so much as reported, and the Pentagon verified it, that the Pentagon has been compiling a base of 12 million youth, age 16 and over, who are considered potential recruits for the military. And so the military is has created this database that includes things like grades, results of aptitude tests, hobbies, interests, gender, race, ethnicity, etc. And some of the things that are compiled in that database, number one, they need to be erased after a period of time, and the Pentagon has not done that. But number two, even compiling some of the categories of information is illegal. And so the teenagers are suing, saying, look, this database shouldn't exist. It's an invasion of privacy, and it's illegal under federal statutes. And, you know, we'll see where that goes, too.
Yeah, my understanding is for citizens in general here in the U.S. have approximately 850-some pieces of data collected on them in various databases around the country that are accessible to corporations.
Yeah, and if you know where to look, it's not just accessible to corporations. It's accessible to anybody who can get on the internet and look in the proper places. Privacy in this country has really become an illusion.
Moving along, you mentioned the Pentagon. The Pentagon is looking at letting some detainees go?
Yeah, there's about 500 prisoners remaining in Guantanamo Bay, and the Pentagon announced this week that it's going to release one-third of them. It didn't say when it was going to release them. They've already been held, in most cases, for four or more years, and the Pentagon announced basically that these guys were innocent, that they posed no security threat to the United States so far as they could tell. Well, there's two questions here. One is why they were held so long in the first place, when many of these cases, it has been pretty obvious that they were picked up by mistake or just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or somebody who didn't like them sold their name to Pakistani intelligence and it went from there, etc. The second question is, why can't they be released right now? Why are they continuing to be held in isolation, to be abused, in some cases to be tortured, at Guantanamo Bay, and we've learned all this from people who've been released in the past, and who suffered through that even though they were innocent, why are these people continuing to be held? It's good news that they're going to be released, presumably, eventually, but it begs the question of why they can't get out now. All right. What happens to the remaining two-thirds of people who are in legal limbo and who are still being held under unmentionable conditions?
Jumping to international, Mexico is looking at some decriminalization.
Yes. The Mexican legislature passed on Friday, and Vicente Fox, who is the outgoing president, is expected to sign legislation that basically decriminalizes possession of a wide variety of drugs, not just marijuana, but cocaine, heroin, amphetamines, opium, all sorts of drugs that are being decriminalized in small amounts. And it specifies the amounts that are being decriminalized that you can have possession of. And in some cases, they're fairly large personal use type of amounts. Now, buying and selling these drugs is still illegal. The same legislation actually toughens laws for trafficking in larger amounts. But this is a piece of legislation that is truly alarming the United States. And what they're afraid of course, is that in the same way that people go down to Tijuana to buy medications over the counter that are not available that way in the United States, that they're also going to go down to Tijuana and buy stuff that they can self-medicate with. Why people should be alarmed about the free market at its finest, I don't quite understand. But, good for Mexico, and we'll see what happens to this because, of course, Mexico is a primary recipient of U.S. quote-unquote assistance in terms of prosecution of the war on drugs. So there's going to be some friction over this, I would almost guarantee it.
All right. And jumping all the way over to Iraq. Any developments this week?
Oh, lots of developments this week in Iraq. We found out more about the new prime minister that was named literally as we were going on the air last Saturday. Where did it go here? I haven't memorized it yet. Jawad al-Maliki. He is a hardline Shiite. He's just as hardline, if not more so, than al-Jafari, who's the guy that was basically forced out by pressure from the United States. He is basically a thug, and he has been very, very careful to advocate in all cases for more Shiite power and not for a centralized national government of unity. More interestingly still, this supposed national unity government that the United States forced the Shiites to adapt didn't include any of the secular parties, didn't include Allied Alawi, any of those different parties. What they did is they made common cause with the radical clerics of the Sunnis and formed a government that way, and the same with the Kurds. So there is nobody in the national unity government among the various political parties involved that, number one, believes in a secular Iraq, number two, believes in a nationalist Iraq. All of these different parties want power devolved to the various provinces and constituencies. So it's not a national unity government. It's a government that's going to push very hard for the Shiites to have autonomy in the south, for the Kurds to have autonomy in the north, and for the Sunnis to be left holding the bag. It's also, in this case, al-Maliki does not believe at all, unlike his predecessor, in negotiating with the insurgency. So the opportunity for a political settlement of what has really become a civil war in Iraq seems to be much farther away than it was before the United States pushed for this government of national unity on the theory that it would prevent civil war. So once again, Washington seems to have screwed up and just made the situation in Iraq worse. That shouldn't really come as any surprise at this point. There were a number of other things that came out this week. The Washington Post revealed that six more U.S. inspections of Interior Ministry jails since we discovered that 173 people were being tortured and abused at a Interior Ministry jail in November. Six more jails have been inspected since then by the U.S. military, and in almost all of them there has been evidence of continuing prisoner abuse, continuing torture. It looks like this is an ongoing problem despite all of the U.S. diplomatic pressure to try and get it resolved, and will continue to be a problem as long as hardline Shiites and their militia continue to be in control of the Interior Ministry, continue to be in control of the National Police. That's where the death squad activity is coming from, and that's a fair part of the reason why things are descending into civil war in Iraq. We have also this week a report in the New York Times that on Tuesday that, and I'll just say this as a direct quote, that troubled decision-making and execution was just as responsible as security concerns for the complete failure of reconstruction efforts in Iraq. In other words, there was a lot of waste, there were a lot of poor decisions, there was a lot of money that shouldn't have been spent that was on projects that were doomed from the beginning because of engineering problems. There's a lot of room for investigation of what American companies and the American government did to screw up reconstruction. It wasn't just a function of the fact that it was unsafe because of the insurgency, and that's kind of a major development. 60 Minutes had a program Sunday night, which, like the New York Times report on NSA spying, a significant part of the 60 Minutes report had actually been scheduled to air before the 2004 elections, and it was a comprehensive overview of the evidence that the Bush administration not only lied, but as we now know, basically used a systematic campaign of lies and disinformation and scare tactics in order to stampede the country into war. The thing that was new that wasn't available in 2004 but that was aired last Sunday night is a top-ranking CIA analyst or former CIA analyst, a guy named Tyler Drumheller, who says that, among other things, the United States had flipped and the CIA actually had on its payroll and was talking to the foreign minister of Saddam Hussein's government before the invasion. So they had access to the inner circle of Saddam Hussein and everything they were talking about and everything they were deciding. Unfortunately, the White House dropped this guy as a source, as a hot potato, when he informed the Americans that the weapons of mass destruction that they were basing a war effort on actually had not existed since the early 1990s, that Iraq had destroyed them, which turned out out to be true. So they got this directly from the Iraqi foreign minister in Saddam's inner circle, who they had on their payroll as a source, and they not only didn't believe him, but discounted him as a source because he gave them that information. And when the CIA objected, what they were told was, this isn't a matter of intelligence, this is a matter of policy, and regime change is going to go on regardless. So they had all this information that WMD did not exist, and they convinced the American public otherwise.
All right, talking with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and just the website and the contact phone number.
There, Eat the State comes out every couple weeks. Current issue is out. Back issue is also available. www.eatthestate.org.
And now, the man who refuses to ease media ownership rules, Mike Cannon.
Again, that was a little segment called Eat the State. Up next, a very disturbing report from an Iraq veteran who gave a very, very telling and disturbing description of the abuses he witnessed while at Abu Ghraib and other U.S. military prisons in Iraq. I have to warn my listeners, this is a very graphic depiction. This report by Black Box Radio will run 10 minutes long, then will be followed by the nationally produced This Week Iraq Body Count. That'll be followed by a 2-minute report of Israeli war crimes. That's what we do each week on the Mike Cannon Show. Bring you voices and witnesses from around the country and the world. Voices you hear nowhere else in central Wisconsin except on this indie media radio program, The Mike Cannon Show. Again, the following 10-minute Black Box Radio interview is of a very graphic nature and will be speaking the true realities of the Iraq War.
Aidan Delgado, Iraq War veteran, recently spoke in Ann Arbor about his time in Iraq and in Abu Ghraib prison, using a slideshow of photos.
Some of Delgado's descriptions are very graphic.
Hi everybody, my name's Aidan Joshua Delgado, I'm 24 years old, and I'm a veteran of the Second Iraq War. Most of the guys in my unit had never left the United States. Certainly they'd never been to the Middle East. So they lived in a state of complete culture shock all the time. And as a result, they were terrified of the Iraqis. You know, I never heard Iraqis referred to as Iraqis while I was there. It was always Haji this and Haji that. Haji is the current anti-Arabic, anti-Muslim slang being used today. It's very, very prevalent in the military. It's derived from an Arabic word, Haji, which means one who's been on the Hajj, the pilgrimage to Mecca, which is one of the pillars of Islam. But in English usage, in the soldiers' parlance, it has the exact same connotation as gook or Charlie or nigger. And that's exactly how it's used. And it becomes such a part of the atmosphere that had gotten into our paperwork and had become part of the bureaucracy. People don't really like to talk about racism in the military or poor behavior, you know, because that's our boys, you know, and it represents us. But the reality was a lot of guys did things there that I know they wouldn't have back home. In one instance, an Army Master Sergeant, one of the highest enlisted ranks, had been walking through Nasiriyah, and a crowd of children about that age surrounded him and started bothering him for food, water, candy, in the way that kids often do. And instead of replying to them, he reached into the back of the Humvee and picked up a detached steel Humvee antenna, which is one of those bars bent across the bottom of the screen. And he lashed these children with this steel bar in front of like a dozen of us. And honestly, nobody moved, you know, nobody reacted. We'd become so blasé at this point that it had become kind of the routine and the norm. The fact was that most of the guys in the unit had been stewing in anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment since 2001. And these sentiments found expression in Iraq, first in the way they treated the corpses of people who had been killed, later in the way they handled civilians they came in contact with, and ultimately how they treated prisoners when they were under their thumb at Abu Ghraib prison.
Delgado spoke about the months he spent in service at Abu Ghraib prison.
Abu Ghraib wasn't like a U.S. prison. It wasn't like a cluster of buildings. It was almost like a city unto itself. It was several square kilometers on each side. And we housed about 4,000 to 6,000 prisoners inside who lived outside in barbed wire enclosures. The detainees were housed in canvas tents, about 60 to 70 prisoners per tent, set on a wooden floor with a pit or a slit trench for sanitation, hemmed in by barbed wire. The conditions inside the camp were very shocking to me. I'd always thought the U.S. Army was like the apex of professionalism. When I got there, I found that we had a very large problem with communicable diseases. If the prisoners didn't have a communicable disease, they soon did. We also had a big problem with dysentery inside, because the food being served the Iraqi prisoners wasn't from the U.S. Army stores. It had been subcontracted from a Baghdad food service. And when it arrived, it would be rotting or would have rats or cockroaches inside, and the prisoners would get dysentery after they ate it. When I arrived at Abu Ghraib, honestly, I thought that this was a necessary evil. I looked around at these horrible conditions and I thought, well, you know, it's bad, but maybe it's necessary. Maybe these are the people trying to kill us. You know, these are the most dangerous people in Iraq. That's what I thought when I first came to Abu Ghraib. But working there, I actually got a chance to find out differently. I was shocked to find that the vast majority of people in Abu Ghraib were there for petty theft, public drunkenness, and forged coalition documents. In addition, a large percentage of the people inside Abu Ghraib had been put there having committed no offense at all. We had a policy of random sweeps, which meant that every time the base would come under fire from the outside, we'd send out military police forces, sweep up all the men in the area, bring them into Abu Ghraib for questioning. We'd question them and find out they were innocent. But the process of release was so bureaucratic that it would often take upwards of 6 months for prisoners to be released from Abu Ghraib, having only been brought in for questioning. So when I found this out about who these prisoners were and what they were doing inside Abu Ghraib, I found it impossible to square that knowledge with the treatment they were receiving. And I began to feel a strong revulsion for what was going on in Abu Ghraib and for what my unit was involved in. One particular incident, there was a prisoner who had smuggled in a pistol and shot one of our guards in the chest. The guard had been wearing his hard ballistic plates, so the bullet didn't penetrate. He kind of knocked him down and took the wind out of him. In retaliation, the guard shot that prisoner in the legs with a shotgun and broke both of his legs below the knee. They then took him to Baghdad for treatment. Instead of loading him on a stretcher, they dragged him on the shattered sort of mass of his legs out of his prison cell and up into a truck. They threw him in the back of it. And this was a big guy. He was like 300 pounds. And they made him kneel on the sort of mass of his shattered legs in his underwear. And it was freezing cold outside. My sergeant was driving the truck. And my sergeant turned and said, you know, this guy's not going to survive. It's freezing cold outside and he has two broken legs. He won't survive the transit to Baghdad. You know, clearly that prisoner was a dangerous guy. He had smuggled in a weapon. He had shot one of the guards. I'm not disputing that he was dangerous and needed to be controlled. What I criticize is the extra additional brutality, the cruelty that wasn't necessary. And that's really what began to turn my stomach about Abu Ghraib.
Delgado found himself disgusted with conditions at Abu Ghraib. He began to identify with the prisoners. This led him to apply for conscientious objector status.
When I looked across the barbed wire at these guys, I looked at them and I said, man, these are young, poor, uneducated guys who didn't have a lot of options back home. I looked to my right to the guys in my unit, and I said, man, we're exactly the same. I was trying to see if there was any way I could live with myself being in the military. And ultimately, I decided that I couldn't, that I could not be the kind of Buddhist, I couldn't be the kind of man that I wanted to be. So I went to my commander, I turned in my weapon, I said, look, I'll stay, I'll do whatever you order me to, I'll work as a mechanic, but you can just take this weapon back, because I'm not going to fight and I'm not going to kill. I want to be processed as a conscientious objector.
Delgado officially began the process of becoming a conscientious objector, but had to remain in Abu Ghraib until his term of service was up. During this time, he faced harassment and ostracization from his officers and former friends. It was not until long after he had returned home that he became officially recognized as a conscientious objector.
Compounding the physical conditions was the interaction between the guards and the prisoners, which was uniformly very harsh and very brutal. But the situation had been worsened by the fact that most of the guards here had not been trained to do corrections. In late November, the tensions inside the prison camp had reached a boiling point. The prisoners had torn up their tents and were marching around, chanting slogans and holding up banners in protest of their living conditions. They were tired of the cold weather and their lack of cold weather clothing, the quality of food being served them, which, as I said, would be rotting or would have parasites, and actually not being allowed to use tobacco was one of their main grievances. The demonstration became very unruly. The prisoners picked up stones and pieces of wood from the floor and began throwing them at the guards. They hit one of the guards in the face. He was a friend of mine. He got kind of a cut on his nose. In response, the military tried to quell the disturbance with non-lethal rounds, but it didn't work, and they had mixed lethal and non-lethal rounds in their weapons. They then requested permission to use lethal force, and they got it. The battalion gave the command, and they opened fire on the prisoners. They shot 12 of them, and they killed 4 of them. 3 died immediately, and 1 died later of his wounds. So our unit was tasked with transporting the bodies of the prisoners who had been killed in the November 24th demonstration. They were to be taken to mortuary affairs to be cleaned up and returned to their families. But before doing that, the soldiers on the detail diverted the truck to an open field in Abu Ghraib and stopped to pose with and mutilate the bodies of the people they had killed.
Delgado showed the audience a photo taken by men in his unit. The photograph showed one soldier posed with corpses of Iraqi civilians, while other soldiers looked on and flashed the thumbs-up sign. The photograph was reminiscent of lynching photos taken in the U.S. around the turn of the 20th century.
This is a member of my unit scooping out the previous detainee's brains with a plastic MRE spoon, while 4 other soldiers look on and 2 take photographs. But this is the reality. A lot of the soldiers there had no respect for the Iraqis when they were alive, and certainly they had no respect for them when they were dead. And this was really quite an all-too-common practice. And people would have you believe that Abu Ghraib was the work of a few bad apples. But I really don't buy it, because it was going on in my unit. It was going on in other units. It was going on in the South. It was going on in Qasr. It was going on prolifically throughout the military. And it was such a culture and an atmosphere that I really don't buy it when they say, oh, it's just a few bad apples, a few crackers from West Virginia.
I'm Megan Williamson.
And I'm Betsy Palazzola for Black Box Radio.
Choice is an illusion created between those with power and those without.
What do all men with power want? More power.
Now they knew who was master and leader. Sheep, thought I.
You said we're headed to war in Iraq. I don't know why you say that. I hope we're not headed to war in Iraq. I'm the person who gets to decide, not you.
Remorse for what? You people have done everything in the world to me. Doesn't that give me equal right? I can do anything I want to you people at any time I want to, because that's what you've done to me. If you spit in my face and smack me in the mouth and throw me in solitary confinement for nothing, what do you think's going to happen when I get out of here? Well, I haven't done enough. I might be ashamed of that for not doing enough. Maybe I should have killed 400 or 500 people, then I would have felt better. Then I felt like I really offered society something. I can, but I find more real in the world that I'm in than I do the tinsel. And the real world is the one I have to deal with every day. Believe me, if I started murdering people, they could not be left.
Chemical weapons threat. Terrorists dangerous die. In turn, murders.
There are some who feel like that, you know, the conditions are such that they can attack us there. My answer is bring them on.
As of Monday, May 1st, 2006, 2,399 United States military personnel had died in Iraq since the start of the invasion. 17,648 United States military personnel had been wounded, over 5,000 of which had suffered grievous injuries such as amputations. 206 other coalition forces had also been killed.
Join us or die.
According to the British medical journal Lancet, over 100,000 Iraqi civilians had died since the start of the invasion.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier. Just so long as I'm the dictator.
What do you see when you're in the dark and the demons come?
You are listening to a radio. Because of the time it takes for radio to travel to Earth from distant sources, radio astronomers are able to see the universe as it appeared more than 10 billion years ago. The artificial radio broadcast you are listening to now portrays the universe as it was just 1 second ago. Stay current. Listen to the Mike Cannon Show.
This is a summary of Israeli war crimes committed in Palestine for the week ending 26 April 2006. Israeli occupation forces escalate attacks on Palestinian civilians and property in occupied Palestine. Here's a summary. Three Palestinians were killed by Israeli occupation forces. Two Palestinians were extrajudicially assassinated by Israeli occupation forces in Bethlehem. 20 Palestinian civilians, including 10 children, were wounded by Israeli occupation gunfire. The Israeli occupation forces continued to shell Palestinian areas in the Gaza Strip, especially in the northern area, wounding three Palestinian civilians and damaging a number of homes and civilian facilities. Israeli occupation forces conducted 38 incursions into Palestinian communities in the West Bank, especially Nablus. 72 Palestinian civilians, including 5 children and 4 women, were arrested by Israeli occupation force. One home was transformed into a military base by the Israeli occupation forces. Israeli occupation forces have continued to impose a total siege in occupied Palestine. A Palestinian civilian drowned in raid floods when he attempted to bypass a checkpoint near Nablus. Additionally, Israeli occupation forces have closed border crossings of the Gaza Strip. The north of the West Bank has also been separated from its south, and Israeli occupation forces arrested 5 Palestinian civilians, including a girl, at a checkpoint in the West Bank. Israeli occupation forces continue to construct the annexation or apartheid wall in the West Bank, and Israeli occupation forces razed areas of land in the Yatta village south of Hebron. Israeli occupation forces use force against peaceful, nonviolent demonstrators organized in protest into the construction of this apartheid wall. For more information on these gross human rights violations and war crimes, you can go to www.phrgaza.org.
That's all for this week. Gripes, comments, or complaints, please feel free to contact me at themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. That's all one word, themikecannonshow@hotmail.com. Enjoyed this week's Indie Media Radio program. Each Monday we try to bring you voices from around the country and the world, other alternative views you'll find nowhere else on mainstream media except here on the Mike Cannon Show. So until next week's broadcast, take care.
Thank you.
This has been the Mike Cannon Show. This has been Glee Glee Productions, specially made for WNRB Central Wisconsin Community Radio. I'm Mike Cannon.